Good morning, diners and travelers and drinkers and bakers and...
Who knows, huh?
Yeah, you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and today we're bringing you a program that I would call Healthful.
Is it Healthful? Okay.
Healthful.
All right, there you go.
Yeah, we're going to start off with an interview with Alana Chernila. I'm sorry.
Oh, there you go. Keep working.
Alana Chernila, who's all about homemade. And she has a previous book called The Homemade Pantry, and now she's taking us under her wing to teach us how to construct and utilize the homemade kitchen. Cookbook author and cook, of course, Alana Chernila is a multifaceted person, having done so much with her life so far. Her current book that we're going to be discussing is The Homemade Kitchen. But Alana, I was just fascinated with all the different things you did before you got to this discovery that your world really was food.
It's true. It took me a little while to get there, but my career has always, I've always tried to be resourceful, and that has taken me in a lot of different places, and I feel pretty lucky that I ended up working at the farmer's market in my town, or else I probably would have never realized how much I wanted to work in food.
You're in New England.
I am, yeah. I'm in Western Massachusetts, where I live in the town that I grew up in.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and right now it's all red and orange and gorgeous up here.
Yeah, I loved you said that you get a kick out of the tourists. They think that once they're not there, the whole town disappears.
Exactly. Yeah, I've grown to love the tourists. I've worked in, you know, restaurants, and my grandparents owned a bed and breakfast when I was growing up,
oh,
so I understand that, you know, it's created a lot of rich cultural activities and good food in the area. So I'm grateful, but it is a little funny when they think that the whole town doesn't exist when they're not here.
Now, you've organized this book. I mean, I want to just preface it by saying you have a strong philosophical component here because you really believe this is the important thing that you do in your life and that it motivates or inspires all the other aspects of your life. So you've organized this book around, I don't know if you actually literally have these sayings on your refrigerator door or not, but that's what you said.
Okay. I really do.
So tell us what some of them are.
Well, you know, they've really grown over the years, and so the book is organized around 13 different phrases, and some of the most important ones in my kitchen are... There's one that's do your best and then let go. That's one of my favorites, which I just think is so important to remember in food and in life in general.
Yeah, I do too.
I also another one that I really try to keep right there where I can see it is slow down, which I'm constantly needing the reminder, and food helps me do that every day.
Right.
But there, yeah, each of these phrases has really helped me find ways to eat in ways that reflect the way I want to live. Because I feel like, what other basic need do we have in our lives that we can really do in our own way? And then we have this opportunity to sort of make these choices every day to help us live the way we want to. So I, you know, that was really the basis for how I created this book. And it's been really neat to hear the reactions to all these different phrases and how they're playing out in other people's lives, too.
Well, you know, most of the people commenting on your book note how charming it is. Well, I mean, that's a reflection
of
you.
What are you laughing about?
No, yeah, I mean,
it is a charming.
Peter had the same reaction. But what I'm saying is that basically that she's infused this book with her personality, and the real charm of it all is her.
Oh, thank you. Well, it is, you know, I'm there on every page, and maybe someday I'll be able to write just a cookbook that's just recipes with no person in it. But at this point,
yeah,
my food
does
is
that
all
anymore.
Me.
Yeah, nobody does that anymore.
Have you ever cooked professionally?
I have baked professionally.
Baked.
So I've worked in several bakeries, and really, again, it's their jobs I've fallen into. So I haven't been to culinary school, but I've done a lot of professional baking, and I have done some catering. Essentially, when people ask me to cook or bake and want to hire me to do it, I figure out how to make it work. So that's what I've done over the years. And I've also done a lot of waitressing. And I find, I take service very seriously, and I feel like learning how to be a good server is actually a really big component of food education, because, you know, I learned in restaurants how to have joy in giving people what they want and what they need and taking care of them.
So what
I'm
do you
really grateful for that.
What do you think about Danny Meyer's move to make all of his restaurants no tipping?
You know, I'm feeling pretty mixed about that. I understand where a lot of the argument is coming from, and I know that, you know, servers are really underpaid, like everyone in the food industry, but I don't know. I'm still forming my opinion. How do you feel about it?
Well, I mean, I really understand how the sous chefs feel, because they're drastically underpaid for what they do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I kind of lean to the pro side on that, on this tipping.
I've worked in a couple of restaurants where tips actually get shared in the kitchen as well.
Yeah, it's not really legal, actually.
No, but it's, you know, that's an interesting solution to the problem. So I feel like this is a conversation that's going to keep carrying out in a big way in the next couple months, and I'm curious to see how it works.
Well, now that Danny Meyer's involved with it, I mean, I think it's going to jump into headlines, so.
I think you're right.
Well, back to your book here. You say, start where you are. Now, I think that's pretty interesting. You know, I mean, how to cook an egg. I mean, there's been a whole book written on just that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The classic example are people who bought these complicated cookbooks and then really tried to replicate the recipes and were total failures. I mean, that would certainly turn you off on cooking, wouldn't it?
It's true. You know, I think that it's so important to me in, you know, when I'm writing recipes and when I'm writing books, that I want to set people up for success, because you know, that's how we cook. And I think it's especially with that first chapter where I go through each of these skills, that I feel like each of those skills, how to make fresh pasta, how to make a salad, how to cook an egg, they're all things that are really building blocks to being able to make whatever you want in the kitchen. And I also, you know, I come to that chapter and called it Start Where You Are. I feel like Start Where You Are is really the introduction, and then the first chapter is Be a Beginner, where we go through all those skills. And I feel like it's essential for us to really come to the kitchen as beginners, because if we are there to prove something and to be perfect and to jump ahead of the skills that we know, then we're just setting ourselves up for failure, and it's not going to help anyone. So I really want to help people have the tools they need in order to really answer their own cravings and cook exactly the way they want to.
Yeah, it's essentially a how-to-cook book, isn't it?
It is. It is. And it's funny, I didn't, you know, my first book was about making basic pantry staples from scratch. So the first book, it carried you through the supermarket aisles from, you know, from the bakery aisle to the snack aisle to the dairy aisle. And so I really got my start in food writing through helping people make things instead of buy them. And I never expected that my next step would be a cookbook that was a general cookbook of how to really come to the kitchen. But that happened because the questions that came about from all this cooking from scratch were like, why is this worth it? And why should we be cooking at all? And is dinner time important? And how do I come to the kitchen without drudging through the work? And so this book really, I had to answer those questions for myself. And that, you know, that's how it came about.
But you got interesting input from your family members, who are the lucky ones, I guess, who were actually the recipe testers.
Oh yeah, they are my first testers, and luckily they all have different palates, so I have a lot of different input there.
And then you also have a lot of neighbors that you involve in your activity as well.
It's true. I live in a small town, and I actually live in a house that I share with my parents, And also I have a 17-year-old sister. So I have a big family of, you know, it's sort of a non-traditional situation, but it's pretty wonderful. And I mean, it's work, but it's good. So we have four parents and three children between us all. And, so I have a lot of tasters.
That's great.
Well, we had the same situation until Anne's mother passed away. She lived with us for almost 30 years. And we're still in the same house with the same two kitchens, the same two refrigerators, the same 48 stairs from one floor to the third floor. So our situation is very similar, and there was quite a lot of times when there were two meals being cooked at the same time here too.
Yeah. You know, it's surprising to me that more people aren't combining families in that way, because it saves resources, and I think, you know, for me, I get to have my children get to be with their grandparents, and I mean, I understand the appeal in being your own family and being a grown-up and being on your own, but the reality and the practical day-to-day of having more support is just more people around, it's good for all of us.
Let's take two examples out of the book that I picked. Talk through how the recipe came about, and then sort of what's special about it that makes it so successful. The first one I was really intrigued with was garden pie. Garden pie is sort of a reward for everyone who was involved in doing something quite different.
It's true. So the garden pie is, I love that recipe. It's a real potluck staple for me. And, you know, the essay that accompanies that recipe in the book is about a group of people who I've been getting together with once a month for the last 10 years. And we're five families, and we all meet, and we work on one person's house for the morning or the afternoon, whichever the family chooses. So we call it work party. And we, you know, work will be working in someone's garden, or we'll be painting, or really doing anything that they have been waiting to get done. And then the payoff is that we have a huge meal at the end and a party. So first we work and then we party. And garden pie is really a recipe that came about through some of those meetings, because I needed something that I could make ahead of time that people would love, that would feed a lot of people. So it's quite a big recipe. It makes two pies, and it's this delicious mixture of pureed greens and feta and egg and leek. So it sounds a bit like a quiche, but what it really is a very, very green pie, and it tastes almost like a spinach pie, because it also is packed with fresh herbs like dill, and it has some walnuts, so it's got even more protein. So it has this great texture, and it's beautiful. It's this beautiful green pie. It's great warm, it's great cold, and, you know, it's a really good party dish.
It's sort of like a quickie on steroids, right?
Right, exactly.
Now the other one that caught my attention, because it's sort of like put it in the oven and forget about it, was the lamb shanks.
Oh, yeah.
I love that one.
So tell us about the lamb shanks.
Yeah, so the lamb shank, that's a staple for us here. And, you know, it's such a sort of rich and delicious dish. So I love lamb shanks. I feel like they're a very underappreciated cut of meat for home cooking. You know, we'll order them in a restaurant, but people often don't know what to do with them at home, and I find shanks are just, they're such a wonderful braising cut, and they're often inexpensive and available from farmers. So, you know, if you know to ask for them, you ask for the shanks, and I braise them in wine and herbs, and really the whole dish just goes into one pot, and I can tuck it into the oven early in the afternoon, and it just sits in the oven and bubbles away and fills the whole house with the smell of everything wonderful. And, you know, I like to, as I say in the book, I like to make that dish, especially on days when my husband and I have dinner after the kids have gone to bed, which we do every so often when we really need a date and we haven't been able to get out, you know. So, and I'll just make two lamb shanks, you know, and we have the, and it has this wonderful braised vegetables and sick sauce, and It's really my favorite way to eat lamb. I love that dish.
Yeah, I mean, I find they're getting so expensive. Even lamb shanks, lamb is getting expensive.
Well, yeah, lamb is expensive, so any part of it's expensive.
Yeah,
it's true, but especially I find if you have a farmer who's selling meat, the lamb shanks are often not as coveted. So,
right.
I tell people to go that route as well, because also I find that locally farmed lamb shanks tend to be smaller, and I like them more. The meat is more tender, and I like the flavor more. And, it's really not expensive for two shanks. But it's true, the sad part about meat that people start to discover is that then to discover it, right? Exactly, like, I have a recipe in the book for skirt steak, which was an inexpensive cut of meat, and now everybody's eating skirt steak.
You can find
it's getting more expensive.
Well, now here's the interesting deal, and then we'll conclude. This is our end of the same kind of thing, I guess. So I asked Anne the other day, do you feel like tongue? We haven't had tongue for ages. What do you think about having some tongue? She said, that's a good idea. So I called our local butcher who deals with local farmers, and I said, do you have any shanks? I mean, do you have any tongues? Because he always used to have frozen tongues in his cooler, and you could get them any time you wanted. So I called him on Wednesday. He said, no, I don't have any. I said, oh, what a shame. He said, I can probably get you some tomorrow. So yesterday afternoon on the way home from another errand, we stopped at the shop. And sure enough, there we had three beef tongues. We always do them three at a time because the recipe's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Has a lot of steps in it. So you need to make enough for a long time. Now, do you have another dish that's sort of like that that you can share with us before we close?
That I like to make a lot of.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's often how I cook. So I have a dish in the book. I have a whole chapter about inviting people over and about dinner parties. And I have a recipe in there that I love to feed people with, which is just a nice, basic braised pork shoulder taco. And that's one of those dishes that pork shoulder doesn't take a lot of work, but it just takes a lot of time in order to really tenderize it and infuse it with all that flavor. So I like to do a lot of pork shoulder at once, and then it freezes so beautifully. And then I can just pull out a container of braised pork that I've done with some spices, some oregano and chilies, and then I have ready-made gorgeous pork tacos for dinner even on a weeknight. So I think I love those cuts of meat that take more time, because you'll rarely find me with a boneless chicken breast in my house. I like to have the bones around. I like to have all the different pieces so that I can make use of all of them. I find that they're all treasures.
Yes.
Well, we totally agree with you, and that's sort of the way we cook too, in our own small way. But we've never gotten around to writing a book about it. We thank you for doing that.
I hope someday perhaps you'll put all your wisdom on the page.
This is a book for all those people who don't think they can do it, but it turns out you know that they can, and you show them the way, and you show them not only a way to cook, but a way of life as well, which is really rather fascinating, and something that you could just read this book as a book.
Oh,
never. Even if you never cooked a thing,
plenty of stories in there.
Yeah, it would be a life to live. So we wish you continuous success and happiness in the life you live with you and your family. Thank you so much for talking to us today, and I'm sure we'll hear from you again on the printed page.
Well, thank you. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you both.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. In my mind and to my taste, there's probably nothing more satisfying than a pie, sweet, savory, or whatever, and leave it to the pie lovers of this world to sort out pretty quickly the best pie shop around, which is what they did in Philadelphia when they hit on Magpie. We're going to be talking to owner Holly Ricciardi, who will tell us about their specialties.
Well, hold on a second. We're going to couple this with another M, an M which actually probably goes into pies too, because right after Magpie, we have an interview with a lady who's a specialist in the production of
maple syrup. Which is riding the charts at this point. We're going to talk to Katie Webster on maple. She has maple syrup in her blood, she says. Well, you know, I would like to eat all of these things, Holly Ricciardi, in this book. Magpie is the name of your pie shop.
Correct.
And you call it a pie boutique in Philadelphia. Yeah, I have a friend who owns a place, a bakery. She calls it the sweet boutique.
Exactly.
So, but you do sweet and savories, and I'm in love with everything in your book.
But oh, thank you.
I just have no luck with pies, and you pinpointed the very first problem is called the crust.
Yes. Now, and in the book, we only have one pie crust.
Right.
That's all you really need.
Yeah, but now it's very special. Tell us why your pie crust is so special.
Well, when we were developing our pie crust, we wanted to make sure that it had the ability to transform itself from a cream pie to a custard pie to a fruit pie, and that it would refrigerate well and that it would hold up well at room temperature. So when we were developing it, there was a lot of things that were important to us. Structure, and of course taste, which a lot of people forget to season pie crust. We stick sugar and salt in our pie crust, and it's funny how many people don't, and that makes a huge difference. This pie crust also can stand up to all of our savory pies that are in the book as well.
That's unusual.
It's a great crust.
Yeah.
Yes.
I thought I'd even try it because it sounded so good, but as I read it, it got more complex.
Oh, it's actually not that complex. You know, once you do it and you see, like, how basic it is, it's just, there's just making sure things are cold, making sure that have your butter frozen and cutting it in and not overworking it and not putting too much water in. But once you figure that out, pie dough is the easiest thing to make.
Yeah, I can hear my mother's voice in my head about how I should go about making pie crust, and I never could make it. A double crust just defeated me altogether. Well, watching people who make great pies, they do have a certain touch to it. And
yes.
I just don't have that.
You know, like anybody, you can become very good at the more and more something, which, my gosh, I don't know how many pies I've made at this point.
Probably a million
but I
and
do
a half,
it.
Huh?
Yeah. Probably. So
no, you use, you say, all-purpose white flour.
Yes.
And you have a protein content. I never knew you got to choose your protein.
Yeah, content. So to understand flour, protein in flour, all-purpose flour has about 11% protein in it, where a pastry flour, cake flour has about 9% and a bread flour has about 13%. That makes a lot of sense when you're talking about gluten structure and making sure that there's stability because bread has to rise and fall, so it needs to have a lot of strength. Where your cakes and other things that use a more delicate flour, you're more worried about them being tender and not tough. Well, of course, pie dough, you want the perfect combination of, you know, tender and having good structure. So that's why all-purpose flour is really just the key to the best pie crust.
Well, but you recommend Pillsbury or Gold Medal.
Yes. Yep.
Bleached or unbleached?
We use Gold Medal at the shop.
And you use unsalted butter with a 23% to 24% fat content. I didn't know you could do that either.
Yes. I mean, You definitely want a butter that is a good quality. You don't need to use a European style. I would say that for the caramel sauce recipe that's in there where it really counts. But what you would want to use is a good, like a Land O'Lakes, a Keller's. You don't want to use anything sort of generic or a lower grade because you won't get that fat content that you need in it, which gives it a lot of flavor as well as flake.
You would use cultured butter.
Yes. You could probably use cultured butter. Yep.
But then you also use vegetable shortening. I thought,
yes.
My mother used to use Crisco, and I thought that was a no-no.
No. You know, it was so funny. I was raised on an all Crisco pie crust
so
because
my mother
used her great-grandmother's recipe, which used lard.
Yes.
So she always just switched out the Crisco for the lard in that recipe at that time. But the reason why we use a little bit of Crisco in there, the importance is there's a melting point difference. So butter has a lower melting point temperature than Crisco. So as you have these nice little pockets of Crisco and these little pockets of butter that are like sort of enrobed, encased in that gluten from the water and the flour that we just mixed together, what's going to happen when it goes into the oven, and which will give you your flakiness? What happens is that the butter will melt out before because it has a lower melting point temperature. And so the flake will not be as high, where the Crisco has a higher melting point temperature, which will then allow that flake to develop and set. So by the time the Crisco melts out, you'll have a flaky, you'll have a multiple flakier pie crust. We just use a bit in it. But, you know, people, if they are uncomfortable using Crisco, we totally say, you know, just replace the Crisco with butter and it'll be fine. But we really enjoy the result of having that little bit of Crisco in our pie crust.
Well, you have some really creative recipes here for pies, like rosemary crumb, apricot rosemary crumb.
You can do really anything. That's what's so great about pie. It is so versatile. You can have so much fun, and you yourself can become an artist and pie maker by just playing around. We sort of give you little tips and tricks and also, like, here's some suggestions. Do you want to switch it up? We do a lavender crumb on top of our mixed
berry. Oh, I saw that because I have big lavender bushes.
Beautiful. It's such a beautiful flavor combination. Our lime custard with our basil infused whipped cream. A lot of people at first were sort of like, oh, basil whipped cream. But once they taste it, what happens is that basil has that anise quality that actually has a sweet quality to it. That when you infuse it with a little sugar and heavy cream, it's absolutely delightful, especially with lime. It's so nice. So you can really have a lot of fun.
Well, yes. I told you I'd like to eat all of this. I just don't want to make it. I mean, who is this cookbook written for? People who want to get started
I wrote this book because, I want people to start making pie again. We just don't make pie anymore. And I wanted to break it down into very, like making pie is very easy. You just have to, like, time it a little bit, you know, but you can make a pie without it being an all-day daunting task because you can break these steps up very easily throughout your week or because pie dough freezes beautifully for 2 months.
Oh,
so there is just no reason why you can't make a batch of pie dough and throw it in your freezer. And when you're ready to make a pie, say you went picking somewhere or you saw these really great plums at the store, you can just pull out that dough and let it sit in your fridge overnight, and it's completely ready to go and be rolled out to make a pie. You can actually even make most of these crumb toppings in advance and put them in the freezer so that all you have to do is dump that crumb top right on top of your fruit pie. But I think we forget that we can break these steps up so we can have pie on a Tuesday night without it being cumbersome or anything. Having only one crust was really important. I mean, even for me at the shop, it's very important to have one crust. And then just explaining. You know, when people understand the science behind something, it makes sense to them and then they're more willing to do it. Like, oh, okay, I get it now. You know what I'm saying? It's just friendlier. So that's what I try to do with a book, giving a lot of instructions, showing people how to do things easily, but reminding them that it is a lot of, there is time that you put into it, so you want to get the best result because of the effort you put into it. And if you just follow some of these little steps and principles, you'll be able to do that. You'll have a great success.
Now, here's a question I have, and I, I think I got an answer before, but I don't remember. When you're making a pie crust,
yes.
do you actually bake it twice? You bake it once and then put the filling in and then put a top on and bake it again?
No.
You don't do that.
The only time you would do that, there's sort of, if you are going to make a custard, say like a pumpkin pie or any kind of pie that bakes low temperature, okay. you do have to partially bake the crust prior to it having the filling put in, because the problem is you want to make sure the crust is done and set, because the temperature will be too low and you'll have a big sloppy crust, which is not what you want, because that second bake is more important of setting that filling than baking the crust. The only other second time you would fully bake the pie crust is if you were making a cream pie that does not require any baking, like a coconut cream pie or the chocolate blackout pie, which is basically you're making a pudding and putting it inside,
exactly.
And then putting it in the fridge to cool.
Now, when I was growing up, which was World War II, my mother used to make egg custard pie, which we all adored. But you couldn't get fresh eggs much of the time, so she would have to use powdered eggs to make the filling. So she would mix up the powder and water, I guess, to make the filling. But then what would happen is she would start baking it, and the crust would flow to the top.
That's really bad.
No, I mean I always used to wonder why. I said, Mom, why does the crust always come to the top?
That's really
good.
That's really neat.
I mean, it did come to the top.
Right.
That sounds like that strawberry pie I made in Australia, yeah. where I remember my mother pricking the dough in the pie shell. So
yeah.
I missed out on the fact that she then baked it. So I got dough, rolled it out, put it into a pie pan, then pricked all the dough on the bottom, and then put the filling in.
Oh, my.
It was a mess.
You put the filling in.
I put the filling in. It went all under. It soaked under the crust.
Right. It just sank right down in.
Yeah.
Well, no, I'm puzzled though. You didn't cook the crust.
I forgot to cook. I mean, I didn't know you had to cook the crust. I'm not a pie
Well, I just asked that question, and the answer came back, no, you don't cook it first.
Yeah, right. Oh, if you're, she
I'm
was,
really
oh, did she make a fruit pie? Did you make a strawberry fruit pie?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't know.
No, I just put the liquid in, and it sunk underneath. And
you put the liquid in.
Boiled up the stew,
okay.
the
right.
crust.
So it was like a custard, right?
It was
a liquid filling.
So that was just too much liquid.
No, yes. It wasn't. You have to bake the crust, Rabbit. Please
well,
don't
I just,
take a...
That's the question I just asked. I said, do you bake the crust first, before you put the filling in?
And so on certain pies, you do.
Somebody said, well, somebody just, the answer came back, no. Now, if the answer is,
no, I think
some
you just
pies,
misunderstood.
Anyhow,
let's
well, some pies you do. Most fruit pies, I would never recommend anyone pre-baking their crust before they put their fruit filling in. But if you're going to do a custard pie, like you have to bake, like a pumpkin pie, you would definitely want to partially bake that.
Well, let's get back to your book here. Is you have not only the sweet, you have all the savory stuff and some really interesting things. I'm looking at the shepherd's pot pie with cauliflower mash.
Yes.
You have a ham loaf pie, Parmesan walnut breadcrumbs. Do you have?
Yes.
Does she have one of those quickies?
That's somebody mispronouncing quiche. Croque Monsieur pie. I mean,
yep.
the wonderful things. Now, what in the world is a fried pie? What is that? Is it a fried pie? You something about a fried pie?
Pie fries.
Pie fries, yes.
That's what they are. So I'm sure I'm going to start explaining this to you, and you're going to go, of course my mother did that. Everybody's mom did it. So when I was, you know how you should never really eat a pie the same day you bake it, because you have to let it rest to allow all the juices to go back into the fruit and all that thickener to settle in and do its job by absorbing all that liquid. So since you really can't eat the pie the same day you make it, but you have all these nice scraps of all these this pie dough. So what you do is you gather it up and you chill it and you re-roll it and then you cut it into strips and you put an egg wash on it with salt and sugar, like raw sugar, and you bake them off. They're delicious. So my mom used to do it, but she would stick cinnamon sugar on top of it. But every time I tell
you that's
story,
what we had, cinnamon
sugar. Yeah, somebody's mom, everyone's mom did that. But So that's what we do. So at the shop, we have obviously a lot of scrap dough. Because of all the trimmings we do, that we make these pie fries, and we give them out with, like, lattes or hot chocolates, or we make house-made ice cream, so we'll stick, like, one of the little pie fries on the, with the ice cream.
You have more than just pie recipes in here.
It's like that guy. It's like that guy in New York City who made the cheese sticks. And then he found out that he had all these odd-shaped pieces of cheese stick dough left. So he made them into another product. I forget what it was called.
That was good. I like that.
And they were really good.
William McMacy. Yeah, that's good. Do you know our friend in Seattle who runs the pie camp?
Oh, yeah.
Katie, you know
heard
Katie?
Of it? No, I've heard of it.
Oh, she's wonderful. She's good pie books out.
And great.
Yeah.
Awesome.
But she has pie camps. And people. Now you do classes at your bake shop.
Yes, we do pie classes twice a month. Yeah, so they're a lot of fun, and people totally enjoy them.
Oh, I'm sure. And people love.
They
pies.
Get to go home with a beautifully baked hot pie, which is so great.
Gives them a great excuse for eating pie, right?
That's right. Right. And it's a great end out. You know, it's like a little hour and a half, 2 hour class, so it's perfect. Such a great time for anyone.
And you don't. Do internet sales in your pies, do you?
I do not. And there is a reason why I don't do that. I do not do any kind of online ordering because it's going to sound weird, but I feel like it turns it into processed food. And that is everything that I'm trying not to be. I want you to eat it.
New York State that does Concord grape pies that I used to order. I can't remember. They come with a nice ceramic pie thing, and a little pie bird in ceramic.
That's adorable.
Oh, it's really a good seller, too.
No, I don't ship my pies. I just have this whole, like,
Well, Holly Ricciardi, I would like to come and eat some of your pies.
Oh, I would love to have you there.
Sure, you can come here and bake me pies. I'd be happy to do that. But for everybody else, try getting the book called Magpie, which is the name of the sweet boutique, the pie boutique in Philadelphia, and practice that crust.
And you can do something the Pope Francis didn't do when he was in Philadelphia.
What's that?
You didn't give him any pie, did you?
I did not. No, I would have loved to.
Oh, you would have loved to. Okay, maybe you can make an excuse and ship him one.
Maybe he can
make an exception.
Everybody else was making like things with his face on it and stuff. What was it?
Yeah.
I was mozzarella with a face.
Well, we're not going to make any more suggestions.
Okay. Anyhow,
perfect.
Holly, it's nice meeting you, and thank you so
much.
And your book is wonderful.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
You know, the subject of maple, as in maple syrup, keeps coming up. It seems to be very much in vogue, or at least on everybody's minds lately. And I had a million questions about it, many of which have been answered with this new book called Maple, 100 Sweet and Savory Recipes Featuring Pure Maple Syrup. And we're going to be talking to its author, Katie Webster. Hello.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for having me.
Well, I mean, it's something as simple as maple syrup. You take for granted, but there's so much I didn't really understand about it. And we interviewed the woman from Tonewood. Do you know that product?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and that a few years ago. And I was surprised that she was kind of early in promoting maple syrup, because it seemed to me to be something that was very special from a lot of different sources. I mean, not the stuff you buy and put on pancakes in the supermarket, you know?
Right, right. So there's two very different things. There's table syrup, and then there's maple syrup. And the maple syrup is a product that is made from trees. It comes from a maple tree. It's just basically maple tree sap that's been boiled and boiled and boiled and reduced until it is thick and sweet and caramely. And table syrup is something completely different. It's a corn product, and it's flavored with artificial maple-like flavor.
I see.
So it's like,
to imitate it.
Yeah, it's high fructose corn syrup, right?
It is not high fructose. It is it's corn syrup.
But it's substantial.
You know, you have this opening section. I mean, the photographs are just charming in this.
Oh, thank
as
you.
Well. Especially your children drinking the syrup right out of the spout in the tree. They're so cute.
Thank you. Right. Well, you know, the sap itself tastes sweet straight out of the tap. So, you know, they like to drink it right out of the tap when we let them.
Yeah, you said that your husband's grandfather, was it, used to start every day with a cup of the syrup, and your kids would like to do it too?
Yeah, so this is a true story. So my husband's grandfather used to start every day with a little dish of maple syrup. And he did it until he was a very old man. He grew up on a dairy farm, and that's just, you know, the way he fueled his body. My kids, I think they would just be over the moon if they were allowed to drink a plate full of maple syrup every morning. I'm sure I make sure that they have it over their oatmeal.
So now you start out with, you give us the history of, if this is an old practice of tapping trees for the syrup, huh?
Yes. I mean, it's actually hard to find the true first time it was made in the history books. And there's some, you know, there's some debate about how it was invented. But most people agree that it was the Native Americans that started doing it. And they did it, maybe they discovered it from the frozen icicles and a broken branch tasting sweet, or, you know, they don't know exactly how it was discovered, but however it was discovered, at some point by, you know, the mid-1700s, both Native Americans and the settlers were making maple syrup and using it to, they were either using maple syrup or they were using maple sugar, which is just basically maple syrup that's been boiled even longer until it's all of the liquid is gone.
Well, now, I mean, you use sugar maple trees.
Right.
Specifically. There are other kinds of maple trees you can't tap, right?
You can tap any kind of maple tree, but the sugar maples are the ones that have the highest sugar content in their sap. Basically, when you're making maple syrup, it takes 40 gallons of sap to make a gallon of maple syrup.
No wonder it's so expensive.
Right. It takes a long time to reduce it that much. And so you really want to find the sap that has the highest sugar level to begin with, so that you have less processing to do.
But there are other trees that, I mean, this is a process the trees go through in the spring when the syrup rises, or the sugar rises, right?
That's right. That's right. It's a natural process that happens when the ground thaws, and there's this sort of like natural sucking of from the pressure outside the tree trunks and inside. It's this cool thing that I just learned about why it actually happens, but you know, it makes the sap run through the tree, and people just tap into that. So you can do that with any tree. Sugar maples just happen to have the best sap for it.
Now, if you didn't tap the tree, what would happen to the sap?
It would just keep flowing through the tree trunk, and just it's basically flushing out of the trunk.
I mean,
out of the branches.
Does it sort of break out and trickle down the outside of the tree? Or?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't ever. You know, it stays within the trunk of the tree.
Unless you let it out.
Exactly. So you're basically, when you're tapping the tree, you take what's called a spile. It's this little metal spout, and you hammer it into the tree, and that breaks into that that trickle, and you're basically breaking into that trickle and allowing it to come out, and you catch it in a bucket. You hang a bucket from the little spile and drip, 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 hours and hours of dripping,
really?
And collect a full bucket full.
But it doesn't hurt. Please tell me it doesn't hurt the tree.
No, it doesn't hurt the tree at all.
See, that's the first thing I said to Peter. If they're taking this, does the tree need this? But you write in your book that you only take a certain amount, and there's plenty produced in the tree.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
so it is
absolutely
sustainable.
I mean, here's the thing. It's in a sugar maker's best interest to take care of their trees, because it's not like a field crop where, you know, if you have a bad year and you know, something happens to your crop, well, there's another year coming. Dozens and dozens of years for these trees to get to maturity. So it's in the sugar maker's best interest to take absolutely great care of their maple wood. So, no, it does not hurt the tree at all, and they've studied it extensively. There's a few things you can do to make sure that you don't harm the tree. So some of the things you can do is you can alternate where you put the tap into the tree, so you don't tap it in the same place every single year. You know, there's a little bit of scarring where the tap goes in, but it heals itself really nicely. And then, you know, you just want to make sure you're not tapping little tiny trees. They should be a certain diameter before you start tapping them.
Now, one of the biggest revelations, I guess, in the book is the extent to which you use recipes with maple that are savory, not sweet. I mean,
Right.
Sort of, we've been talking sugar, sugar, sugar all the time, but in fact, there's a roundness of flavor that exists. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, that was sort of one of the main reasons I wanted to write this cookbook, was that maple syrup is not just a sweet thing; it's also very flavorful, and it can be used in savory recipes. So, for example, you're familiar with pad thai,
yes.
Right? You know, so
yes.
Pad thai usually has a little bit of sugar in it. It's a savory noodle dish, but it has a little bit of sugar. And so in the case of this cookbook, the pad thai is sweetened with a little bit of maple syrup.
And that's good for you. You point out here that the guidelines for women is, what, 2 teaspoons or something of sugar a day, or...
What? So the 2 tablespoons
two
a day.
Tablespoons,
so you're referring to the maximum amount of added sugars.
Yeah, and the, you get more flavor and sweetness out of the maple syrup without adding on the extra sugar and calories.
That's exactly right.
Well,
so
that was impressive.
So basically, you want to keep your daily sugar, added sugar, under 2 tablespoons a day. That's for women. For men, it's a little bit more.
3, I think you said.
I think, yeah. So, you know, that's not a lot. So you really want to get the most bang for your buck.
Yeah.
You can get it from just plain refined sugar. But in the case of maple syrup, you're choosing a sweetener that cup for cup has micronutrients. It has antioxidants.
Oh, yeah, that was another thing I wanted to mention. I didn't know that. I mean, you're not getting any of that with regular, like, beet sugar.
Right, it has minerals. They've done a bunch of research on it. It actually has anti-inflammatory properties. It's lowering the glycemic index. So it has all of these, you know, things in its corner to make it a healthier choice. You know, you should stay under that 2 tablespoon max. But, you know, if you're going to choose to use sugar, then, you know, choose one that's going to be healthier for you.
Well, you know what I like about your book is it's one of your missions, in a way, is that you wanted these recipes to be detailed and bulletproof, and that's what you've come up with. And they're interesting recipes. I mean, you've done such a good, solid job of devising these recipes and making them understandable, and you give tips throughout. But are they really foolproof?
I think so. I think, you know, I was just looking through a couple of them, and I was thinking, boy, this one's actually so easy. This one's really easy, too. So I tried to make them all recipes that, you know, a home cook could follow, that they would be able to find the ingredients at their grocery store. I didn't want any of them to be too offbeat or obscure, but I wanted them to be modern and different from, you know, some of the old-fashioned maple recipes that you might think of.
Yes, they are. They're very creative, I think, too. I can tell you one I'm not going to try is this salted maple, what is it,
the fudge.
Fudge. Now that one, and I'm not going to do the maple leaf cookies either. They look like you have to really be right on top of the
thermometer. Both of those, you need to have a candy thermometer for sure.
So what are some of the recipes, if you were looking through your book, that you would like to draw attention to?
Well, I can tell you the ones that I've made over and over since I developed them.
Okay.
That's probably a good test. I would say that the sweet and smoky turkey chili is one of my favorites.
Yes.
We actually had that for dinner last night. I swapped in venison for the turkey.
Oh, nice.
And it was delicious. So it has, you know, just the ground meat, you brown it with onions and garlic, and then you add in a ton of chili powder, cumin, and then I deglaze with a little red wine vinegar. I found that vinegar was my faithful ally in a lot of these recipes to help balance with the sweetness. I have fire roasted tomatoes and chipotle in there, and then a splash of that dark maple syrup, and it really just makes the whole thing have this sweet, salty, sour, smoky thing going on. I mean, it's fabulous. So that's one of my favorites.
Yeah, we're going to make that, right, Rabbit?
Oh, I expect so.
Yeah, and, you know, this calls to mind one of the other things I really liked in your book is you have that section of BFF flavors that go with maple syrup. Can you run through some of those?
Right. So the BFF. So those are the ingredients that make maple taste more maple-y, basically. So things that have naturally high levels of something called sotolin, which is a chemical compound that tastes like maple. So it's found in all sorts of things we eat, from, you know, walnuts and pecans to it's actually in celery.
You said that. You said celery is one of these?
Yep.
I can't even imagine that.
Next time you taste some raw celery, think about maple syrup and you might taste it.
Yeah.
So anyway, these ingredients, when you add them to a recipe with maple syrup, they really just play nicely together and they will bring out that natural maple flavor.
Now, I must be one of the few people in the world that doesn't know what BFF stands for.
So that's best friends forever.
Okay. That's for the rest of the audience, huh?
That's right. Yeah, so, you know, things like pecans, rum, these are all the classical pairings that you're like, oh, yeah, of course, I know these flavors together. There's a reason why they're often paired together.
Well, I like the way you start off the book with cocktails anyway.
Right.
Why not? Yeah.
You're obviously on the right track. There's no question about that. I guess it must be what you do in the dark winter nights in Vermont.
Oh, sure. Yep.
Well, you're so accomplished, Katie. You have a blog. You have you develop recipes. You teach fitness classes. I mean, you're a Wonder Woman, lady.
I try to sleep sometimes.
Well, this is a delightful book, and I thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
It's called Thank you Maple. So much for having me.
Yeah, it's called Maple, and it's Katie Webster. And check out her website, which is healthyseasonalrecipes.com.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And finishing up today's program, a topic that's popular with just about everybody, just about every ethnic group you can imagine, although they might have a different pronunciation, a different name for it, everybody thinks Sunday dinner is a big deal. And our good friends with the University of North Carolina Press found a nice lady who could produce a book on the subject of Sunday dinner. So just in case you don't know how to do it, listen up and you'll find out. Welcome to On the Menu, Bridget Lacey. How are you this fine day?
Oh, good. Thank you.
And you're speaking to us today from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yes.
But you've just made an important contribution to the lore of cooking in the South, part of a series called
Savor the South.
Savor the South. And this one's unusual in that it's not dedicated to a single ingredient. It's dedicated to a whole concept called Sunday dinner. And Bridget, perhaps you can explain how you managed to get the publishers of the series to allow you to do something so different than the rest of the series.
Well, I approached Lane Meisner about writing about Sunday dinner because I told her I needed more than a single ingredient. I wanted the whole meal. Sunday dinner was such a big part of my life growing up that I had a natural affinity for that subject. And so while I was well aware of the single ingredient focus of the series, I felt that Sunday dinner would also fit into it.
Oh, I'm sure you're right. And it turns out that Sunday dinner is a tradition everywhere. Sunday dinner is a tradition when Mama and Nonna do the cooking in an Italian kitchen. It's a rite of passage, if you like, that gets passed down from one member of a family to the generation which follows. Something you talk about in your book, but you have some even more down to earth advice. Just listeners, to give you an idea how much use you're going to get from this absolute jewel of a little book. Because I have the page marked right here. No, I did have the page marked.
And I undid it.
And undid my page marker. But it basically was some rules for how you make sure that Sunday dinner is successful. And two of them I thought were particularly poignant. And, of course, I can't poignant them because I can't find the page anymore. But one of them says, start with an empty dishwasher.
Absolutely.
which I think is really very clever, because unfortunately in our house the dishwasher is always already half full, so that means only the man or the woman of the house can load it. Whereas if you have it empty, then you can say to people, well, just put it straight in the dishwasher. Don't just pile it up in the kitchen.
Absolutely.
Oh, I remember the other one, and use your best china and silverware. What are you saving it for?
Yeah, I feel like why not get the real stuff out of the cabinet for the people you love? You know, people are always waiting for that special day, but I think Sunday dinner is that special day.
Now, why is it that fried chicken is really dominant in your book?
It's only one recipe, but I do mention it several times.
You do,
but
right.
I think Southerners love fried chicken. I think... you know, in fact, a lot of people call it the gospel bird, and it's become associated with you go to church on Sunday, and later on you get, quote, the gospel bird.
And I think the other thing that might have something to do with it is something you can fix fairly fast.
Absolutely. And it tastes so good. It's hot and crispy, and a lot of times people may not have time to fry chicken during the week, but, you know, on Sunday it's that nice little treat.
Now, you don't have vinegar in your collard greens.
Uh-uh.
I put the vinegar on the side because some people like it and some people don't, so I kind of use it as a part of the serving, like chopped up onions and the vinegar. It's on the table for people to kind of use as they like.
Yeah, I like the red wine that they had in Charleston.
Oh yeah, that's good.
Yeah, the Charleston Grill. The collard greens are from Wadwalla Island, and the vinegar came from the mind of the chef, Robert Wagoner.
Yeah.
Sweetheart, go ahead.
Oh, I thought that you had some, you were saying something.
Well, the
we mentioned that a lot of these dishes are not really purely Southern, and that's because you've lived around and you've just collected the kinds of things that you like to eat, and those are the kinds of things you would serve at Sunday dinner, no matter where you were.
I think that's right. I mean, I took different influences. For example, I lived in Binghamton, New York, and I used to go to a wonderful restaurant called the Copper Cricket Cafe, and I would order the Amaretta cheesecake. And so I included that in as one of the recipes. Even though I will say every place I lived, there are Southerners there, so they bring some of their food with them. I mean, I've eaten peach cobbler in just about every state I've lived. Uh-huh. People may add their own, you know, like a regional ingredients to it. But I think it's a mix of things that are Southern staples and then some interesting things that I think kind of just elevate the meal.
Now, you indicated that it's a very sad thing socially that the tradition is dying.
Absolutely. I think now people don't live near relatives. I think people are often on the go. But what I make the case is that Sunday dinner is not just about the food. It's the fellowship. It's the hugs. Those small and big conversations. It's passing on knowledge from one generation to the next. All of those things kind of occur during that meal.
Well, I also thought on your list of things that you can do to make sure your Sunday dinner is successful is to invite people who are not members of the family, people who perhaps otherwise might be eating Sunday dinner on their own, and you're creating your own Sunday dinner group.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you know someone at a church, an older person, a neighbor, a colleague, you know, why not invite them to Sunday dinner? And I invite people to also bring a dish. I think we often eat the same combinations of food. And so it's nice when someone brings their dish and you're like, oh, I wouldn't put that together, but I love the way that tastes together. So it's also a way of adding dishes to your menu.
And your repertoire, too, is assuming that you like them after people have brought them.
Well, at least I want to try them.
Well, you say this is your first book?
Yes.
Okay, you have another one coming up?
I'm thinking about comfort food next, because there's so many foods that bring us comfort for different reasons. You know, you might need comfort because you're pregnant. You might need comfort because of something horrible that's happened, an illness, someone's passed. So I think foods that bring comfort might be my next book. And I enjoy talking to people about what dishes that means for them. So it's not just my story, but it's their story, too.
Good idea. Very good.
Thank you.
Well,
see if you can get another title more than one word past the Sailor of the South people. I have a feeling you're mighty persuasive and that might happen. So you must come back and talk to us when that takes place or whenever else you're writing about something that is really part of this fascinating series or some other subject which is appropriate to your heritage and your experience.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Bridget, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Have a good afternoon.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, listeners, there you have it. Until same time, same place next week when we hope you'll join us again. In the meantime, what do we say?
Bye-bye.